This episode includes details of murder scenes, including unsettling descriptions of murder, sexual acts, body mutilation, and post-mortem, as well as the aftermath experienced by victims of attempted murder who survived and shared details of their attacks, which may be particularly distressing for some listeners. As such, listener discretion is firmly advised.
AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS The Lost Voices.
With your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Marty.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s and noughties. Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's do it. So here we are again for the second part of the Michele Lupo episode, who was a gay man with HIV/AIDS status that murdered four men, three of them gay, young men as well I should add, in London in 1986. And he was also convicted for attempting to murder two others, although technically there was three. Now, if you've landed here because you've looked up Michele Lupo or you've just stumbled across this podcast, then really you need to go back and listen to part one and listen to the accounts, the tragic accounts of the victims, James Burns, Anthony Connolly, Damien McCloskey, the unnamed male with the tartan scarf, and those that survived an attempt on their lives by Lupo, Kevin McDonough, Mark Leyland, and where in the previous episode we ended with the sixth man to encounter Michele Lupo, David Cole, who survived Lupo's attempt to murder him. Now, David went to the police and with a covert police unit behind him, they visit the gay haunts of London until David eventually bumps into Michele Lupo. David gives the undercover officers the nod and Lupo is arrested in the Prince of Wales pub Brixton. So, let's listen to David's own words in his police statement in the run-up to Michele Lupo's arrest. I went straight over to the other side of the bar and told detectives I had seen the man who had tried to strangle me. I went and stood in front of the man. Oh, David, you've got some balls.
Gosh,
about
yeah.
In it, about 2 or 3 feet away from him, and said, "Don't I know you?" He said, "No, I don't think so. My name is Michele. I'm French and a musician." He offered me his right hand to shake, which I did because I wanted to get the feel of the man's hands and skin. I know the man who attacked me had soft skin. His whole manner whilst talking to me was the same as the man who attacked me. His head was slightly stooped, his manner quiet, and his tone softly spoken. I knew I was looking into the eyes of the man who had tried to kill me. And as we mentioned extensively in the previous episode, journalists and documentary filmmakers Tim Tate and Ray Wire, who had access to the police case files, and where Tim Tate states on his own website, the Metropolitan Police agreed to allow both authors and filmmakers unprecedented access to a working murder squad. For ourselves, we were assured that there would be no closed areas, no subjects off limits, and no control over what we eventually wrote. And so it proved, doors and, more crucially, filing cabinets were open for us with no attempt to hide what lay behind or within them. And for their book Murder Squad, the pair also had access to the detectives and officers in charge, and they shared their recollections of Lupo's arrest.
Michele Lupo did not struggle when Detective Sergeants Gary Townsend and Dennis Gregory gripped his arms and propelled him forward firmly out of the pub into the night air. From Cold Harbour Lane, it was a short drive to the AMIP HQ at Croydon. The first thing that struck Peter Elcock as odd about their murder suspect was that he declined their offer of a lawyer to assist him. The second was that he readily admitted murdering Tony Connolly and Damien McCloskey.
Lupo is then moved to Brixton Police Station, where he occupies a cell on the ground floor, and a series of interviews take place.
Detective Peter Elcock, who was in charge of the case, later recalled Lupo's demeanour. He was incredibly calm. He just sat there as we went through the allegations with him. Then he said he did the murders. The next day, we interviewed him again and he admitted the Burns murder, biting off his tongue and smearing feces over the body. As if that wasn't enough, he told us he had tried to pull the man's eyes out. There was no question of him trying to duck responsibility for what he had done. I asked him whether he knew what he was doing when he was killing the men, and he said he did, and that he wasn't drunk, but he couldn't really think of an explanation for the murders.
That's quite weird. But in his statement to the police on the 16th of May 1986, Lupo said, he said his name was Jim. We went to the basement I had been to before, and we began to caress. He was quite big, and I think he means in build and stature. I put a silk stocking around his neck, and we both fell on the ground. I was underneath him, and I just kept pulling the stocking. When he was dead, I bit off his tongue. He shit himself, so I smeared it on his body and tummy. My, what a jolly bedtime story this is.
Lupo, in his statement to police, when questioned about the death of Anthony Connolly, said, "The last thing I could think about was sex. Totally the opposite. I felt like wrapping the scarf around his neck and pulling it very tight, which I did."
Tate and Wire, upon speaking to Detective Peter Elcock 4 years after Lupo was sentenced, stated in their book, "Lupo delivered this soliloquy in an even, unemotional tone. He was quite helpful, volunteering details which would make Elcock's job of matching confession to scene of crime evidence easier. It was the details, coupled with their delivery, that worried him." They then quote Elcock as saying, "I have been in the force for more than 25 years. I have never come across a case like this or a man like Lupo. There was no remorse, no sense of what he had done as wrong. He just sat there and said he did what he did. So we'd better get on with doing our job." So he's quite upfront then in saying what he did.
I mean, he hasn't denied it, but like it just shows what like a cold, calculated man he really was.
But I can't help as well but think that he's not really elaborating too much. I do know from the book that Lupo was interviewed twice, or if not three times. It does seem to be that what we discussed in the previous episode about the victims was what he stated to police. But I think the time he's gone back to his cell and had a little thing, I think, could be completely wrong, but he's added a couple of embellishments in regard to, I think he admits that he smeared the feces on Jim's body, but I think that was to remove it from his hands. But when he says he bit out his tongue and tried to pull his eyes out, I think he's perhaps trying to sensationalize the murder a little bit.
Yeah, you could be right there, Will.
He's trying to like elevate his status.
Yeah, trying to definitely elevate his status.
Because he must be sat in his cell thinking, well, right, I have done this, I've been caught. He must know what the outcome's going to be, which is going to be life in prison.
Well, yeah, so why not add more bits on that kind of like make it seem a lot more interesting, So he's got absolutely nothing to lose, has he?
No.
So, Lupo is in police custody at Brixton Police Station and seemingly cooperating, if not volunteering, the details of his appalling crimes. The first whiff of his arrest to make the newspapers was 3 days after his arrest, where the Sunday tabloids report Lupo's arrest. On the 18th of May 1986, the Sunday People run the headline, "Gate Killer Hunt, Gate Man Held."
I won't read the article as they are littered with inaccuracies which would confuse the situation and confuse the listeners. And they end their article by stating Lupo was believed to be 24 years old and from Ulster, when in fact Lupo was 33 at the time of his arrest. And according to the family's priest in the village of Monte Donato, he shared he knew Lupo personally and his family and were all from the village Monte Donato in Bologna.
The following day, on the 19th of May 1986, the press report that Lupo is set to appear before the magistrates at Camberwell Green, charged with 2 murders and 1 attempted murder.
Yes, he is charged with the murder of James Burns and Anthony Connolly and the attempted murder of David Cole at the Vauxhall Lorry Park. Detective John Shoemate tells Camberwell Court that Lupo is still being questioned about other offences, quote, of a similar nature, of which Lupo is brought back before the court at Camberwell Green on the 22nd of May 1986 to hear 2 additional charges, that of the murder of Damien McCloskey and the attempted murder of Kevin McDonough.
So Lupo is now charged with the murder of Jim, Tony and Damien and the attempted murder of Kevin and David. What about the Mark Leyland and the unknown male found on Ungerford Bridgewell?
It was widely reported that Lupo faced only 2 charges of attempted murder. Kevin McDonough, the first to have the misfortune of encountering Lupo, and the last being David Cole, who assisted in Lupo's arrest. As for Mark Leyland, the Daily Mirror on the 10th of June 1986 did report that a 7th charge had been brought against Lupo for the attempted murder of a 3rd man in the Charing Cross area. This would be Mark Leyland. But when Lupo is convicted at the Old Bailey, the press reported only 2 convictions for attempted murder and not 3. Whether this was inaccurate reporting or one of the men withdrew from testifying or is 1 conviction fell through due to lack of evidence is unclear. As for the unknown male on Hungerford Bridge, Tate and Wire share the details from Lupo's statement. Lupo had left Heaven Nightclub in Charing Cross, walked down Villiers Street towards Embankment Underground, up the stairs onto Hungerford Bridge. As he's walking across, the unknown male, said to be homeless, asked Lupo for a cigarette, to which Lupo gives the man the one he is already smarking. When the detectives asked Lupo why he strangled the man, Lupo stated in his statement to the police, quote, "I just had this feeling inside me to kill. I can't explain it. I just had pure emptiness, no thoughts whatsoever. I just decided to do it. I certainly didn't get any sexual feelings." And despite all the sensational claims, not by the press, but by people in recent years in blogs and podcasts, etc., Lupo confirmed he strangled the man with the tartan scarf the man was already wearing. And as we learned in the previous episode, the man was discovered by 22-year-old Stephen McKean on the bridge, which was a footbridge, at 1 a.m. in the morning.
And Lupo was brought back before Camberwell Court for a third time on the 26th of May 1986. He hears the additional charge of murder with regard to the male unknown found on Ungerford Bridge. Lupo made no application for bail and was further remanded in custody until the 9th of June. But who is Michele Lupo?
Well, Michele Del Marco Lupo was born on the 19th of January 1953 in the quaint village of Monte Donato, Bologna. His educational path began at the Leonardo da Vinci Secondary School in Bologna, where he studied until the age of 16. During the years of 1969 to 1971, he engaged in a correspondence course focused on languages and briefly explored art, marking the only known highlights of his early life. In 1971, at the age of 18, Lupo's life took a significant turn when he was drafted into the Bersaglieri 22nd Commando Unit, fulfilling his national service obligation over the next 2 years. Upon his release from service in June 1974, Lupo arrives at Heathrow Airport, commencing a new chapter in London. Aside from intermittent excursions into the vibrant gay club scene of Amsterdam and Paris, he established himself by first taking a position as a hairdresser in Montcalm Street, London SW11. This role would occupy him for 3 years. In 1977, Lupo vanished without a trace, re-emerging in 1980 in a dramatically different context. He transitioned into the world of haute couture, securing a position with Yves Saint Laurent from March 1980 to March 1984. Starting as a sales assistant at their Brompton Road headquarters, Lupo's adeptness ultimately led him to the role of branch manager. It was in these refined surroundings that he began to forge relationships with London's affluent socialites. And naturally, as the branch manager of Yves Saint Laurent, Lupo came into regular contact with the Yves Saint Laurent managing director at the time, Lady Rendlesham, who said of Lupo after his arrest, quote, "He was an excellent salesman and very much liked by everyone whom he served." Now, it was never established why Lupo left such a privileged position at Yves Saint Laurent. I think we can take it when the investigating officers investigated, Yves Saint Laurent weren't able to give a reason for his departure, such as misconduct. It must have been off his own back. However, Lupo took up a role at a lesser-known boutique called Tan Giudicelli, earning a mere £14,000 per year. However, Lupo was only there for 18 months before he lost the job there, and then took up a job at Stravaganza on Oxford Street as a sales assistant, earning a mere £12,000 per year. And during the detective's investigation, Lupo had told them that he'd chosen to come to the United Kingdom to be free both artistically and sexually. Hairdresser David Mercer, 22, knew Lupo through the Yves Saint Laurent store and said, quote, "He tried it on with me, but once I let him know I was not like that," assuming means gay, "he was straight with me," end quote. As a former commando, now turned stylist, Lupo became a prominent figure among the London glitterati. Now, at the time of his arrest, Lupo was living at a flat in Sydney Mews, Chelsea. The flat was owned by Sir Kenneth Adam and his wife, who was a prominent film production designer and had worked on 7 James Bond films in the 1960s and 70s. One of Lupo's ex-boyfriends told the tabloids that Lupo was treated by Kenneth and his wife like a son, and therefore allowed Lupo to live in the flat at a very favourable rent.
When the police combed Lupo's Sydney Mews home, they discovered 2 black leather diaries that held over 700 names of various well-known figures, celebrities and socialites. On the 29th of May 1986, the papers got hold of the story and it ran for weeks. To the bemusement of those listed within it, of all which denied ever meeting, let alone knowing Lupo. The Daily Record ran the headline, "Star Shock, Anger Over Diaries," reporting dress designer closely connected to Princess Diana at the time was furious it'd been named. The Daily Mirror headline read, "Star stunned over gay murders quiz, naming singer Lindsay DePaul, who told the Daily Mirror, it sounds as if it may be a list of people this man would like to know, rather than people he actually knows." A spokesman for Bruce Oldfield said, "All this has clearly come from the police, so you should talk to them. We don't know anything about it and have absolutely nothing to say." And an interesting link, given he was spontaneously asked by police at the time, while opening a shop on Brompton Road, to make an appeal to the public for assistance in the murder of Jim Burns, Kenny Everett, who also appeared in Lupo's diaries. Everett was questioned by police on the 30th of May, and he told the Daily Mirror, "I don't know the man. I have no idea why my name should be in his books."
And Everett repeated the same line to the same paper, this time the Sunday edition, after Lupo was sentenced, where Everett is quoted as saying, "I certainly didn't have an affair with him. Lupo may have been to one of my parties. If he did, thank goodness he wasn't the last to leave, or I might not be here today."
Another hint to the circle of people Lupo was either friends or acquaintances of were highlighted by the Daily Mirror the following year in June 87, after Lupo in his sentence, where it states, quote, "Lupo regularly visited the flamboyant Lady Rothmere to deliver dresses, and police say that when she heard of his arrest, she telephoned the police from Bermuda to demand his release." The Daily Mirror, hearing this, then approached her for a comment, which they printed in the same article. A spokesman for her said last night Lady Rothmere did know Michael Lupo, but not intimately. She says she now has no clear recollection of the man.
The
plot thickens, love.
She rings the police to demand his release. I mean,
there you go.
Who does she think she is? And then when the mirror questioned her, all of a sudden I don't have no recollection of this.
I don't know her at all.
And Lupo's personal life truly became tabloid fodder, given what the police themselves were unearthing through their investigations. Along with stories the press were printing, either through their own sources or perhaps comment and leaks from the police, Tate and Wyatt shared the police doing a background check on Lupo revealed, quote, "The computer threw up a conviction in that name dating back to March 1977. It was for gross indecency. That usually means bugger it in public and is quite frequently the sort of charge brought against homosexual prostitutes. Lupo was fined £40. Now, I don't know if you would, but I disagree. This isn't entirely reflective of male prostitution. It is reflective of gay men cruising. And gross indecency was commonly a conviction based on the fact that, quote, actual sodomy, so anal intercourse, could not be proven. Plus, the £40 fine suggests whatever the police saw was a low-level offence, given I've seen higher fines for the same offence and where evidence in court stated the accused simply invited a guy back to his home for sex. And ironically, like it or not, as of 2017, Michele Lupo was posthumously pardoned for this offence under what they term Turing's Law, given Alan Turing was convicted of the same offence as were many other gay men. Now, Lupo lived at the flat in Sydney Mews in Chelsea, but he had a second address at Roland Gardens, Kensington. Many who have retold this story do seem to glamorise Lupo in that he came here with nothing, worked these social circles, and could then afford a flat in Roland Gardens, Chelsea, with some claiming the flat to have cost in excess of £300,000. All I could find was that this was two properties merged as one, 20 and 22 Roland Gardens, and was a mix of offices on the ground and upper floors, and where the remaining upper floors had been converted into six small leasehold flats. Now, whether he had a mortgage on one of them, I'm not sure. I more swear to think he was renting. However, Roland Gardens is of interest as Tate and Wyatt share in their book that police found another side of Lupo, or rather Rudy, as he called himself, from this address, where they wrote, Michele Lupo had taken out an advert offering the services of Rudy, a homosexual masseur. Rudy turned out to be Lupo and the massage no more than an appetizer for the sex, which was the real commodity for sale. But the sex was not conventional by even homosexual standards. Alcock found letters addressed to Sir, which pleaded with Rudy to torture the writer with chains, whips, crops, clamps, weights, and a device to hang its owner for a lengthy period. Even the walls of Lupo's flat suggested a man set apart from the rest of the homosexual community. Some of its walls were painted jet black and decorated only with the traditional satanic symbols of inverted crosses. But on that subject, as on every other possible motive, Michele Lupo kept his own counsel.
So when Detective Alcock spoke to Tate and Wyatt 4 years later after Lupo was sentenced, he told them, We came to the conclusion for everything we saw that Lupo was an extremely sadistic type. It took us some time, but we eventually discovered what the metal tube found at the scene of Byrne's murder had been used for. There is, apparently, a small but dedicated group of sadomasochistic homosexuals who practice what they call pet shop sex. This involves introducing a small rodent into the passive man's anus via a metal tube. It is clearly incredibly dangerous, not to say cruel, but then the whole business was like that. We believe that this was one part of Michele's Lupo's activities and that some victims may have been attracted to this particular deviant sadomasochistic sex. Well, I've never heard the likes.
And you know what? Researching this, because I'd never heard of it, there's no evidence that it ever happened, that it ever occurred, not just with Michele Lupo, or in this case, as they state, James Byrne's, but it apparently it's just never happened because it is just too dangerous, and it's never been applied in sex. There's no evidence of it applying
well,
in sex.
Well, I've never heard anything so ridiculous in my life.
It is ridiculous, isn't it? Because they're suggesting here that if this was Lupo's fetish and Lupo's thing, that he's carrying a little rodent with him to when he met Jim Byrne's at the Colhern, that he must have had a little rodent in his pocket.
Which is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I don't know.
I think at this point, where I was quite defensive of the police in the victim's episode, this is now I'm just completely lost. I can't.
I mean, this is just it's just appalling, really, what they've actually said.
I mean, they must have had to have dug for this insight. They found the metal tube, which I think, using common sense, it was, you know, Jim had a wound to the side of his head, which he could have got from when he fell. But I think it's either the tube was already on the floor and he just fell there and it just so happened to be between his legs, or Lupo hit Jim around the side of the head with a tube and let go of the tube as Jim fell down and landed on top of the tube.
Well, I think that's a little bit more feasible. I mean, why do people, obviously, the police and everything, think that gay men are absolutely obsessed with anal sex? That's another thing as well.
Animals like rodents have got claws, they've got teeth, they would try and burrow out of somebody. So even if it did take place, nobody would essentially either survive or they'd be severely injured.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that, look at the kind of logistics of it all, Will, as well, where you'd have to get somebody in a certain kind of position to insert the metal tube and then put the rodent inside the set, you know, to kind of direct it up the anus.
So you'd need to be somewhere comfortable, like your bedroom with working electric lights and a bed, as you said, to position yourself to get comfortable, not a derelict basement in the heat of the moment where you're having this frenzied killing of Jim.
In the dark as well.
In the dark, complete dark, yeah. And essentially what it is, from the photographs we see of the basement, a building site.
Yeah, it's the rubbish. That's absolutely rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's quite hard to believe that that's what the police are thinking. So for me, this now, I'm not with Elcock anymore and Shoemaker. I'm just, these two guys are loopy.
Yeah, they are. Totally loopy. Deluded.
And with this story came the voices of Lupo's ex-partners and lovers. And you have a quote that one of the six ex-lovers gave to a newspaper.
I do. After Lupo's arrest, a 28-year-old man known only as Vincent speaks to the press. He shared the pair frequented the Colhern pub in Earls Court as it was close to where they lived. And he goes on to state, he was very promiscuous and his sexual appetite was a large one. He picked up the minimum of one guy a night, and if he went to a nightclub, he might have four or five a night. He liked to play S&M games, but I never saw him use or suggest any form of violence other than that light sadomasochism.
And I wonder what light S&M would be. Is that just a couple of slaps, maybe a slap?
Slaps, bit of spanking, I suppose. Yeah.
A bit of nipple tweaking.
Yeah, that's another one. Right, and after Lupo's arrest, another ex-partner came forward. Stephen Feeney, who first met Lupo in a gay bar around 1984. He told London's Evening Standard, he once claimed to me that he had something like 4,000 sex partners over the years, but he was obsessed with his own good looks. He was horrified when he realised he was starting to get old, just another queer unable to get men. In some ways, he was like Wilde's Dorian Gray. My relationship ended with him because I could no longer handle his promiscuity, which was incredible even by gay standards. I believe his first victim was an accident. He would use asphyxiation as an added thrill whilst having sex, and one day it just went too far. After that, I think he could never match the thrill he got from killing. Murder as the ultimate sadistic pleasure.
And I think both in Stephen and Vincent here, two ex-lovers of Lupo's, and I know that they were lovers for quite a while in gay years, But they're both saying that he's perhaps not the monster that's been pitted. I mean, we know he's done the crimes and they're horrendous they're horrible. We know that. But they're not able to give any kind of background insight that they perhaps expected this or are not surprised by it. They seem to be quite surprised.
Well, yeah, because I was just going to say to you as well, I mean, these people could have had an absolute field day by coming forward, and they didn't.
No, they could have easily have gone with either the truth if they fought it or lied by saying, oh my God, yeah, he was a monster. You know, he nearly killed me a couple of times. You know, he was really into dark S&M and pet shop sex, if that's even a thing. But they're not. They seem to be quite taken aback. And I think that's quite telling, because at the end of the day, regardless of what the police investigation yield or the newspapers, they knew Lupo intimately and they knew him well.
Exactly, yeah. So I'm tending to side with them instead of the police.
As soon as I read this, I knew I had heard the name before, and I quickly realised Stephen had featured in an exhibition at the Fitzrovia Chapel I had seen the year prior, titled The Ward by photographer Gideon Mendel. He'd been given access to the Broderick Ward, the UK's first dedicated AIDS ward at the Middlesex Hospital, which opened in 1987, and where he'd been allowed to photograph its AIDS patients. Stephen featured in the exhibition as he had been photographed on the ward as an AIDS patient and sadly died as a result of AIDS-related complications.
And when the Evening Standard pressed Stephen on why he thought Lupo would kill, Stephen stated, Michel A was very depressed. He had just finished with Guy Dumonte. He was badly shaken by the split, and this helped him go off the rails, I think.
And I think this snippet, this quote from Stephen, again, somebody who knew him well and seemed to be either within the same circle of friends to get this insight, or was still on speaking terms with Michelle to get this insight, is that many people have reported in all these podcasts and blogs, and they've all regurgitated the same information that we'll come on to learn, and I think we perhaps touched on it. Lupo did have an AIDS diagnosis himself. They all claim that 2 weeks prior to him starting his murder spree, he was doing it on the grounds that he was so pissed off that he'd been infected with HIV/AIDS and that he was somehow getting revenge. I think Stephen here is telling us, as you've just said, Michele Lupo was very depressed. He had just finished with Guy Dumonte. He was badly shaken by the split, and this helped him go off the rails. Yeah, he ends it with, I think. And it's going to be interesting because we're going to find out who Guy Dumonte is. And I think common sense would dictate that the reasons behind his killings, perhaps.
Yeah.
And before we look at Guy Dumonte, it's important to note that when Lupo was arrested in 1986, the police unintentionally provided the media with a story they broke their necks to report. And Detective Elcock, when speaking to Tate and Wire for their book, shared, Lupo wasn't exclusively homosexual. We discovered early on, in fact, he told us, that he quite liked going with women, and a lot of women, as well as men, found him attractive. The problem was that he had AIDS. It was left up to us as a squad to try and trace as many of his recent lovers as we could and advise them to have a HIV test. You can imagine it wasn't a particularly pleasant job because he had got in with the trendy set. We had to break the news to a lot of society people, men and women. I personally had to ask one very prominent lady socialite whether she had slept with Lupo. When she admitted it, I had to suggest gently as I could that she should go down to a clinic for her sexually transmitted diseases. But then I discovered Lupo had also slept with her husband, and I had to go around and break the news to him about the AIDS without, of course, telling either of them about the other's involvement. It was a bloody nightmare.
I can imagine it was bloody.
Yeah.
both of them.
I mean, they say that he's a gay killer, and to a degree he killed gay men apart from the unknown male, which we can only assume was heterosexual, but here he is. Sleeping with men under the alias of Rudy as a masseur, and you know, he's said to be out and gay and having sex with men, but he's having all this sex with women as well.
God, he's a nightmare, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a randy beast.
We first hear from Guy Dumonte when he speaks to the Sunday Mirror on the 16th of November 1986, where by this time Lupo is in Brixton Prison awaiting trial. They run the headline, Margaret's Pal in Jail Visits to AIDS Victim, and the article states,
I wonder who Margaret is.
Well, one of Princess Margaret's escorts has been paying to jail visits to a murder suspect suffering from AIDS.
It's Princess Margaret.
Who knew? Bachelor Guy Dumonte, a friend of Margaret's for 15 years, goes to see Michele Lupo whenever he can. Lupo is in the isolation ward of a prison hospital facing charges of 4 homosexual killings in London. He was arrested in May after an appeal by TV comic Kenny Everett to the capital's gay community to track down the murderer. Gimonte, 38, said he had not told the princess about Lupo. Speaking from Rome, he went on, "Michele is a dear friend and I'm helping him through this dreadful time. As far as I know, the princess has never met him." Gimonte's butler, Alan, said, "Michael, or Michele, as he is known, has AIDS. Guy has been a terror of strength to him." Dumonte first met Margaret at a US embassy ball in 1971. He's described by friends of the princess as an official walker who accompanies her to various social engagements. But all Dumonte will say is, "My relationship with the princess is not something I wish to talk about." Dumonte then said 33-year-old fashion shop manager Lupo had been a chum for 12 years. Then he added, "If you suggest anything untoward, I'll break your legs. In the nicest possible way, of course."
Oh, that's charming.
Charming. What a charmer.
Yeah. I can't help but think that, I think Dumonte, the nose that the press are digging for summer. I mean, here he is visiting a murderer who's got AIDS in prison, who's killed these 4 men.
Yeah, and, you know, the royals, honestly, they've got a lot to fucking answer for, will it? Because they're always in the centre of a bloody draw.
It's not Pizza Express.
Oh, no, it's right, that is, isn't it?
But it's, yeah, and he's got, he must have been shitting himself because he's got these connections with Princess Margaret. But you can't help but think that he would just distance himself from Lupo. So I think there's got to be something there between these two. I mean, said that they were in a relationship.
Wow.
And after Lupo is sentenced in 1987, the Daily Telegraph report the same story with additional insight on the relationship between Michele Lupo and Guy Dumonte, where they state on the 11th of July, quote, said he, Dumonte, had known Lupo since his earliest months in London, but denies having had any homosexual relationship with him. Oh, what a liar. I mean, that's very different to what Lupo's ex, Stephen Feeney, had shared when he told the Evening Standard, now quote again, "Michele was very depressed. He had just finished with Guy Dumonte. He was badly shaken by the split, and this helped him go off the rails, I think." Now, the thing is here, Guy was from a very prominent family, but he died in 1992, aged only 42 years old. Guy's death certificate states his sister, who was present at the time of his death at a Kensington residence, was the cause of bronchopneumonia. And we know his death was likely to be an AIDS-related death or an AIDS-related bronchopneumonia, given his death brought about by AIDS is mentioned in the book Living and Loving in the Age of AIDS by Derek Frost, which reads, "We go to Russell Dexter's funeral, all smells and bells plus a requiem mass. Once he was so beautiful, still so young when he died. Russell was the lover of Guy Dumonte, the grandson of the acclaimed Swedish doctor Alex Dumonte and author of The Story of San Michele. Within 6 months, AIDS will also kill Guy." So he's clearly gay to a degree, and he's passed away from AIDS.
God, you know, it's just...
It's quite the web, isn't it?
It is, actually, yeah.
So I think there's got to be some credit to Stephen's comments to the Evening Standard when he said it appears Lupo's gone off the rails because him and Guy Dumonte have split. And from what I could find, Guy and Lupo were in some kind of relationship together for about 2 years.
Right, okay.
And it makes you wonder... When Lupo's in prison, he's going to have lost all his friends and socialites. What hold has he got over Guy to get Guy, who's associated with Princess Margaret, and says that he'll break newspapers' legs if they say anything untoward? Why is he still going to visit Lupo? What's Lupo's hold? As he said, if you don't come and see me, I'm going to spill the beans on our affair.
Yeah, kind of expose him and whatever else he knew, really.
If they've been in this intimate relationship, has Guy shared any secrets?
Yeah.
About the princess or any other prominent socialites and high-profile people that Lupo said, if you don't come and see me, I'm going to tell the newspapers all this. So Guy Dumonte, it sounds like by visiting him in prison when he's got associations with Princess Margaret, is...
It's like really kind of...
Lupo's got a hold on him.
He has, definitely, yeah. Yeah, definitely will. So the trial begins on the 10th of July 1987, 12 noon at London's Old Bailey. Lupo's appearance in court is short and ends on the same day, given Lupo pleads guilty to killing James Burns, Anthony Connolly, the unknown man of Hungerford Bridge, and Damien McCloskey. Along with the attempted murder of only two of the three men, as reported by the press, Mark Leyland and David Cole, who both survived the attempts of their lives.
Yes, and the papers, although slow to report the sentence he received on the same day, some do with headlines such as "The Wolfman Caged for Life" on the front page of the Liverpool Echo, "The Gay Executioner" on the front page of the London's Evening Standard.
The Liverpool Echo, inside the court, report, quote, "Flanked by four prison officers, Lupo of Sydney Mews, Chelsea, a former fashion shop manager, was barely audible as he pleaded guilty to the chain of murders and guilty to attempting to murder two other men."
And as you can imagine, the following day, the 11th of July 1987, the sentencing is not just in every newspaper up and down the United Kingdom, but all across Europe and America. The Daily Mirror not only run the headline on their front page, quote, "Four-time killer is sentenced to death," but they also print a two-page spread with photos of Lupo with the headline, "Dressed to Kill."
The Daily Record on their front page ran "Gay Who Killed for Kicks," and another two-page spread inside with the headline, "The Wolfman." Amongst many other headlines, the Liverpool Daily Post on their front page run with "Revenge of Evil AIDS Strangler." The Nottingham Evening Post run a similar headline, "Deadly Revenge of AIDS Victim." The Newcastle Journal on their front page state, "Gay killer gets life four times."
It's a shame that most of the headlines lean into sensationalising this terrible and these unnecessary murders, whereas the Newcastle Journal tells us that Lupo was sentenced for four life terms. As for the Wolfman and other wolf references, they report that Michele's surname Lupo translates in Italian or means wolf. And despite these labels by the press to refer to him as the Wolfman or the Silk Strangler, thankfully, they don't really take off, they don't stick. I think mainly because Lupo could never be quoted as making any reference to a wolf, such as perhaps saying he stalked his victims like a wolf, nor were the murders, as needless and senseless as they weren't reflective of wolf-like behaviour. As for Silk Strangler, you already had the Boston Strangler from the 1960s, where his murders were referred to as the Silk Stocking Murders. It seems only in recent years that those that retell or regurgitate this story, albeit inaccurately, have applied these terms in a bid to glamorise and sensationalise Lupo and his crimes. Lupo first told police he used Jim's own scarf that he was wearing to end his life, but later said in his statement that it was a silk stocking. Yet many of the newspapers reported that in court, two separate scarves were shown in the murder of Jim and the murder of Anthony. No silk stockings. And in the case of Anthony, Lupo stated in his statement to the police, quote, "The last thing I could think about was sex. Totally the opposite. I felt like wrapping the scarf around his neck and pulling it very tight, which I did." And we know Anthony usually wore, and was that night, wearing a knotted scarf around his neck. And Lupo said he ended the life of the unknown male on Hungerford Bridge with the tartan scarf that the man was already wearing. I think while trying to label Lupo in terms such as the Silk Strangler and the Wolfman is distasteful, it really isn't reflective of the crimes he committed. The only person to mention the, quote, "sock or something," end quote, was David Cole, who survived Lupo's attack in the Vauxhall lorry park.
Given the vast number of newspaper articles reporting Lupo's appearance and sentencing at the Old Bailey on the 10th of July 1987, we've collected quotes from the courtroom voiced by actors. First, the words of prosecutor Mr. Julian Bevan.
"My lord, Mr. Lupo, in the space of 8 weeks between March and early May 1986, strangled to death no less than four people and attempted to murder two others. During the material time, he used to frequent well-known homosexual haunts in the city, clubs and pubs. There, he used to pick up total strangers for casual sex. Once contact had been made with a partner, they used to make their way to derelict areas with the purpose of indulging in sex. Three out of four persons he killed were homosexual pickups. In short, he enjoyed it at the time he did it. In addition, two other men lived to tell their tale after having the misfortune to encounter Mr. Lupo. One was battered about the head, and the other, Mr. Lupo attempted to strangle with a stocking he had in his pocket."
Lupo was appointed Lord Gifford as his counsel at the trial. The press reported that Lupo appeared pale and haggard and was barely audible when he pleaded guilty to the chain of murders. Now, despite Lupo pleading guilty, he still assigned Lord Gifford as his counsel. And I suspect Lord Gifford doesn't try to make any defence because his client, Lupo, has already pleaded guilty. But he does make several statements that perhaps, after speaking to his client, does perhaps give an explanation or a reason or perhaps even a motive to how these crimes possibly came about. And Lord Gifford shares with the court that Lupo, who came to England in 1974, thought that he was a failure, both in his work and in forming any lasting relationship, and that he'd just lost his job before his arrest. And Lord Gifford goes on to tell the court that Lupo felt disgusted with himself, quote, a condition which leads some people to commit suicide. He did not. He killed others, said Lord Gifford. And it's not known if he referred to Lupo's AIDS diagnosis as a mitigating factor or a reality, but he told the court, quote, it exposes him to the risk that he will contract a fatal disease in prison within the next 5 years. However, the judge, Sir James Miskin, sentenced Lupo to 4 life sentences for each of the men whose lives he so prematurely ended. In addition, he was handed 14 years for 2 attempted murders on Mark Leyland and David Cole before he concluded in his summing up.
For a man whose life has been such that he suffers from AIDS, whether it be your fault or not, it would, in my judgment, be absurd to make a minimum recommendation to encourage your release after that time. Against this appalling background of 4 slaughters and 2 attempted killings, life means exactly what it says. Not merely as an appropriate punishment, but because your behaviour has been so appalling, I'm confident you will never be released on the public until the passage of time has so changed your personality that you are totally safe to the public at large, and not only a live danger to practicing homosexuals, but to a sad-eyed tramp catching a cigarette. Take him down.
And as you mentioned earlier, the press jumped on Lupo's AIDS diagnosis and all reported similar stories, such as the Liverpool Post. Homosexual killer Michael Lupo took a horrifying revenge on his gay lovers after discovering he had the AIDS virus. Italian-born Lupo, 34, has always insisted that he did not know he had AIDS until after his arrest in May last year. But detectives who worked on the case do not believe him. Lupo's AIDS diagnosis, which I believe from all that I have read, was confirmed only upon his arrest, as they were by 1986, screening those that came into custody, given AIDS had become a real issue in UK prisons. You just have to listen to the Gregory Richards episodes and the Del Sinclair to hear some of the horror stories. But the detectives believe, not confirmed, that Lupo knew or had found out he had HIV/AIDS in October of 1985, so the previous year.
And his diagnosis is going to be questioned in regard to motive, and Tate and Moyer stated in their book, quote, not naturally, perhaps, Shoemaker and Alcock at first advanced the theory that Lupo had started his murderous career as a direct result of anger at contracting AIDS, but that attractively neat possibility was denied by Lupo in one of the several recorded interviews between police and killer. Though such denials may conceal more than they reveal, in it, Lupo's only attempt at explaining his actions is to suggest that he had felt abused by a number of people over any number of years.
And that would perhaps hint to the breakup of Guy de Montfer.
Yeah.
And perhaps a couple of people that have taken advantage of him just as much as he was taking advantage of people to climb the social ladder.
Mm.
And Lupo stated in his statement to police, quote, I felt so shitty having been used and abused in the past. It was just anger. So I'm assuming he's explaining why he committed these crimes and these murders. I knew what I was doing. I could say I feel sorry, but I'm not. I had a clear mind. I knew what I was doing. I wasn't drunk. I knew. So what's the point of saying sorry? I'm not. I do not believe in things unless I've experienced them. I've tried drugs, but it's not a turn-on. I enjoy being out of my cell. So if you want to go through with it, and Tate and Wyatt note that go through with it means another interview, go through with it. I've nothing more to tell you. Tate and Wyatt, having heard the interview, said, quote, and after that limited self-justification, he, Lupo, fell silent.
Tate and Wyatt, having access to all the police had sourced for their case files, shared, quote, it was never clear to detectives whether this abuse was experienced at the hands of his fashionable chums or whether it was a more general dissatisfaction with society at large. But something appears to have caused a rift between Lupo and London's glitterati. In 1984, he ceased to work for Yves Saint Laurent. There is no record of why Michel Lupo left the comfortable and privileged surroundings of a renowned fashion house. But from August 1984, he took a series of poorly paid jobs as a shop assistant in boutiques from Earl's Court to Oxford Street. At the time of his arrest, he was earning a relatively low salary of $12,000 a year. And not forgetting he was also working as an escort out of Roland Gardens.
So I think even they've admitted that there isn't enough evidence here. And Lupo himself is saying that he's not. And I think for a killer as well, it would have been the perfect timing. 1986, when he's arrested, he's committed these crimes at the height of the AIDS pandemic. Everybody's shitting themselves. What murderer wouldn't jump on it, even if it wasn't true, and go, actually, yeah, I was trying to infect everybody with AIDS?
Yeah, exactly. As I said a lot before, he's got absolutely nothing to lose. So he might as well admit it if there's any truth in it.
Or even lie, if he just wanted to make himself look good. Yeah. You know, be known as the AIDS murderer or something like that.
That's
but
right,
he is,
yeah.
I'm not defending him. I'm just trying to get away from this narrative that everybody keeps repeating, that he learned that 2 weeks before the first killing, he learned he had AIDS and he was taking revenge on people. And
yeah,
strangling people isn't, and I get it, it probably is an element of revenge, killing another gay man by strangulation, but you'd imagine that he'd be wanting to somehow infect them.
Because like at that time, like 84, 85, it was everywhere, wasn't it? You know, the British press had an absolute field day. And so obviously some random gay bloke who nobody's ever heard of, and then he becomes positive, and I'm going to say, ain't they? He deliberately, intentionally infected his victims with AIDS.
And also as well here, they're sharing from the investigation they've conducted that he's somehow lost his job at Yves Saint Laurent, and it seems to be quite a privileged job that he had. He's lost that and is now working in a shitty boutique on Oxford Street at £12,000 a year. Like, I help but wonder what's happened there. I mean, he's very much a charmer. Everybody talks about how charm and smooth he was both before the crimes and after the crimes. Yeah. Even in prison, some people encountered him and said that he was such a charmer, so smooth talking and so nice and pleasant, they describe him as, to talk to. So he's obviously got the gift of the gab. I can't help but wonder, with this sideline of being a masseur and a bit of a kinky bitch in the bedroom and that, these services that he's off selling his body, prostitution essentially, has he bumped into somebody that perhaps shops in Yves Saint Laurent?
Might be.
He's probably gone for the high-end client.
Well, he obviously has something about him as well. And as you say, like, and as we've found out as well, he mixed in Voice Society social circles.
So is it that? Has he perhaps bumped into somebody who's used his services? Or is he perhaps trying to climb the ladder, tried to stab somebody in the back, and it's kind of backfired on him, and they've said, look, you either get out of town, so to speak, or get out of Yves Saint Laurent, or I'm going to dob you in.
We'll never know, will we?
Because it's weird how he's gone from such a nice job, as the police have said here in their investigations, to working in a shitty boutique. Something's happened.
Something's definitely happened there.
I mean, we could speculate to the cows and home, but so we'll never get to know. But something's happened there, hasn't it?
Yeah.
He's then probably perhaps made him angry.
Yeah.
And as Lupo's ex shared, Lupo had become depressed after his 2-year affair with prominent Guy de Montfort had ended.
And Stephen said Lupo, despite turning 30, was starting to worry about aging and losing his looks.
Oh, typical gay.
Exactly, what a queen. So with 4 life terms for murder, plus 14 years and 2 attempted murders, Lupo now has to adjust to his new reality life in prison.
Yes, so he was on remand in Brixton Prison on their dedicated AIDS isolation ward before being sentenced at the Old Bailey on the 10th of July 1987. And to break away slightly, on the 12th of July 1987, the People newspaper ran a story with the headline, "Gay Killer Wanted to Marry Me, Strangler's Secret Love." And the article reads, brace yourself, "Gay executioner Michael Lupo, who killed 4 men for kicks, has a secret girlfriend he wanted to marry. Lupo, 34, while awaiting trial, twice proposed to dark-haired librarian Christine Caitlin from his prison cell, and he wrote her dozens of love letters. As he began 4 life sentences for murder yesterday, Christine, 34, said, 'We are very close. What he has done is not the true Michael. I know what he is really like. What has happened is just not like him at all. I don't think he can really understand it.'" Christine wept. Christine wept as she said at her Chelsea home, quote, "Naturally, I'm very, very upset. I don't know what the future holds. Oh, God, wake up. But as far as I am concerned, we will always be close, no matter what anyone else says about him. I've seen Michael in prison and written to him. What we have said is between the two of us. End quote. Loopy-loo. But friends of the couple revealed that they had exchanged letters nearly every day while Lupo was awaiting trial, and twice he proposed marriage. The couple were introduced by a photographer friend of Christine after he had taken modelling pictures of handsome, dark-haired Lupo. Oh dear, dear oh dear. And I actually found Christine, and I mean, I shouldn't probably say where she works, but it's within the public sector, public services, so it's a little bit worrying. If it is indeed the right Christine, but she does seem to be a bit of a cat lady.
Right.
So I think that probably explains these love letters. But I can't help but wonder as well if she's either been genuinely serious that it was love and marriage and through these letters, or whether she's perhaps just cashing in.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyhow, after sentencing, Lupo is sent to Long Latin prison. Then in September 1988, he is transferred to top security prison, Franklin Prison in Durham, where his arrival is met with protests. Not for his crimes, but because he has an HIV/AIDS diagnosis. And you have the newspaper article there, don't you, Marty?
I do, yeah. Daily Mail reported on the 12th of October 1988, quote, prison spokesman Mr. Peter Siddons as stating, renewed concerns expressed by prisoners on one wing, D wing, about the presence in their midst of a prisoner known to be HIV positive. This has resulted in about 50 prisoners refusing to return to their cells at 8 p.m. on Monday night lockup time. Disagreements emerged between different factions within this group and blows were exchanged. Order was restored very quickly and an inquiry has been investigated by the governor. The article concluded, a Home Office spokesman said four prisoners received minor injuries during the fracas, but no violence or threats had been directed at prison officers.
However, the Newcastle Journal reported that a letter had been smuggled out from a prisoner who was representing all the prisoners on D Wing, which stated, quote, there are still fears among the men that AIDS will spread in the prison, and he warns of possible violence unless Lupo is removed, end quote. And so the governor, Mr. Alastair Papps, ships Lupo out, citing the reason as, quote, for his own safety. Kenneth Morgan, a friend of Lupo since 1978, visits Lupo every 2 months, but I had no luck tracking him down. He, Lupo, apparently had regular visitors, but it is unclear what regular means when you're serving life, and there was no insight as to who these visitors were. In August 1993, Lupo is moved back to the top security prison, Franklin in Durham, but this time he is not housed in general population and instead goes straight into the hospital wing. In the same year, 1993, Lupo has his photo splashed all over the newspapers once again while comparing his crimes to that of more gay men being killed at the hands of what was said to be a serial killer, which turned out to be Colin Ireland. Then the press falls silent. Until
the 17th of February 1995, where the papers report that Michele Lupo died from an AIDS-related illness on the 12th of February 1995 while he was an inmate in Franklin Prison.
And as you can imagine, the newspapers went absolutely crazy. Now, here is just a small snippet of some of the headlines that appeared in the British newspapers. AIDS claims life of gay killer. Killer dies of AIDS. Sex killer dies from AIDS in prison. Gay serial killer Lupo dies in prison of AIDS. AIDS killer dies in jail hospital. Gay murderer dies from AIDS. AIDS victim killer refused treatment.
And given he died while in prison, his death is automatically subject to an inquest which was scheduled to be heard on the 20th of February 1995. But before the inquest, the prison service issued the following statement. During the 18 months he was here, he was in the hospital wing due to the fact that he had the AIDS virus. At first, he was quite active and used gym and sports facilities here and would regularly get visitors. But before Christmas, he started to become more and more withdrawn and lost weight rapidly. It was all downhill from there. He seemed to have lost all will to live.
Then at the inquest on the 20th of February 1995, Dr. Andrew Phipps, who treated Lupo, opened by stating, he wouldn't take any treatment, not even painkillers, until the day of his death when I gave him morphine. Then the inquest was adjourned until a date to be fixed, which was the 4th of April 1995, for a full hearing with a jury.
Coroner Geoffrey Burt was told at the hearing before a jury, Lupo was in severe pain during the last days of his life at the jail. His friend Kenneth Morgan pleaded with him to receive treatment, where he refused drugs.
Oh, I find that it's a bit of a hard one. in the sense of he had no consideration for the men that he killed in regards to perhaps any pain that they felt. And here they are kind of worrying about, you know, Lupo in prison dying of AIDS, which we know is a horrible and it's been documented that, you know, painful death.
Yeah.
That they're trying to perhaps put him out of his pain. I'm a bit torn.
I think, judging by like what we've read and heard, I think it's the fact that he didn't feel worthy enough of receiving any pain relief at all. So maybe this is when his crimes actually caught up with him, because he didn't want a peaceful death. He wanted to die, maybe, as his victims did, in pain.
It's quite interesting you said that, actually, because I had the similar line of thinking, because I think a lot of people would say, oh, he's just being a martyr. But I think when you're dying of a disease, which we know many have said is a slow and painful death in terms of HIV and AIDS, or I suppose it's just the AIDS, is that I too felt in some way, not that he should be, you know, honoured for doing so, but I feel it perhaps is a slight acknowledgement that, you know, I am also going to go out without any pain relief.
Maybe his consciousness caught up with him after all, you know. And I don't know, I mean, it's a difficult decision to make, isn't it? I mean, you know, we obviously don't know the ins and outs of how he felt, how anybody's felt actually dying from AIDS. But I presume that most people who have died from AIDS do want a peaceful exit, you know, into death. They don't want to be suffering and in pain. But, you know, ultimately it was his decision. They couldn't force him. I mean, it's a strange one, Will, that one.
And I think that, you know, Dr. Andrew Phipps saying that he did give him morphine at the very, it seems at the very last minute. I can't help but think that, as I've seen video footage of doctors and nurses that look on of somebody who's dying from AIDS, they do seem to be writhing around in a lot of pain, and they do mistake certain grunts and groans as, and I think he's probably put that question to him, feeling uncomfortable, seeing that he's in pain and going, would you like morphine? And he's perhaps, could have even been a grunt or a groan to reject morphine, but he's given it to him anyhow, which...
Well, I was just going to ask you that, like, did he, it doesn't say like whether he accepted it willingly or it was forced upon him.
So I kind of do get the feeling that perhaps in this instance, Dr. Andrew Phipps has seen that he's in pain, asked him if he would like morphine, and has perhaps just taken any verbal noise that Lupo made to be
as a yes.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there, but I think it's quite weird that he would reject any form of pain relief, but right at the last minute, he was given morphine before he passed away. And the hearing also heard from Dr. Michael Snow, an infectious disease expert, that stated, Mr. Lupo made it clear he wanted no other treatment. He was offered treatment at an outside hospital when he became steadily worse, but he decided to stay in prison. He wanted to be in familiar surroundings. From December, he would not take treatment. He would not allow himself to be treated. He was given nursing care, but would not take any painkillers. On his last day, he did take some morphine.
Friend Kenneth Morgan told the inquest, since August, he refused to take any more treatment. He had never really taken any, but was refusing any offer of treatment. On a visit with Lupo's parents in December, he said he'd been told his death was only a matter of time. The verdict was ruled as natural causes. His death certificate merely stated AIDS.
And I can't help but feel that the death certificate, in a way, is very much in keeping with the fact that he's a prison inmate. Just AIDS. We know AIDS is...
It's not AIDS, is it? It's something, obviously...
A complication
due to, but like, yeah, just stating AIDS is a bit like
you deserve it. And I'm not knocking that. I think it's probably justified. He did die obviously of some AIDS related complications, but it's almost in the sense of we're not even going to bother to investigate or find out what was the cause. Which, to a degree, I find is quite fitting, but at the same time, I think it does kind of question the morals of, you know, how do we treat people that have done bad things? I don't know, it's a tricky
how
one.
Do we there's two things here. There's how do we treat people who have done bad things, and how do we treat people who've done bad things that are dying from AIDS as well?
That's what, so I mean.
Two moral points there.
I think we're conditioned, whether we've got the condition or not, I think we're conditioned to give sympathy to anybody who has HIV-AIDS diagnosis or dies of an AIDS or HIV-related death. So I think it's quite hard when you've got a prisoner here who's done horrendous things. Lupo, you know, he took the lives of these men. So why should we consider the taking of his life?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah, totally.
And I think that's where our kind of moral compass is. It's quite hard to not have sympathy, because obviously he was an arsehole. He was an absolute shit. It's just quite hard to not have sympathy. It's weird. It's just the way I think we've been conditioned.
Well, I wonder how much actual empathy, if any, they had for him in his final days, final hours, because of the despicable, awful crimes that he's committed.
That's a good point. But I think medical professionals, especially working in a prison setting, would have probably already have been challenged and would have perhaps accepted that they're there to help the person regardless of their crime and what they've done. You know, treat the person as a human being.
Yeah.
As difficult as that is for, say, you and I, because I think we'd probably be the first to whip out the life support plug on someone like Lupo, say.
Yeah, yeah.
What's also interesting as well is that where he ended these men's lives, he essentially was in control of their death. And here he is very much in control of his own death by refusing treatment. He's in control.
He could be right there, Will.
He's going to dictate how he's going to die.
Yeah.
But the only thing that really pleases me when you go back to the Newcastle Journal article from the inquest, where it states the hearing was told the 42-year-old inmate from South Kensington, London, was in severe pain during the last days of his life at the jail. It's quite unlike me and you and probably anybody else listening, but my thoughts are good. I hope he fucking was in a lot of pain, because he's one horrible, nasty piece of shit. And I don't think there could have been a more fitting way to end his life through this slow, agonising death. Good riddance.
I think it's also interesting as well that Lupo's parents are visiting him as well, because I can find no trace of his family history whatsoever.
Which is really strange, isn't it?
And there's no trace here in London of his parents being here, and obviously we'll come on to a little in a moment, you know, his estate is valued and goes through probate, but where did it go? Who took it? It must have been his parents, obviously.
It's got to have been his parents, yeah.
They've just vanished and disappeared. And as I just mentioned, probate was granted in London, having died in Franklin Prison with an amount not exceeding £125,000. Perhaps not a testament to his wealth, but his estate didn't exceed the inheritance tax threshold for that year, which was set at £125,000. But I noticed that when an estate that doesn't exceed the inheritance threshold for that year, an estate that is wound up with tens or hundreds of thousands, usually stated the exact amount. And as I understand it, if Lupo did have property, as in the flat at Rowland Gardens, probate would need to be granted first with a realistic evaluation of the property before it can be sold. But I'm not sure Lupo owned a flat at Rowland Gardens, as between him being imprisoned and the year after his death, out of the six flats there that sold, they all exceeded the probate threshold of £125,000. Now, in 1995 alone, the year he died, one of the flats sold for £240,000, which would land them, Lupo's executors or his family or whoever inherited his estate, would land them in serious trouble and hefty fines for under-evaluating the property. So for me, the jury's still out, but I think at Rowland Gardens, he was renting. However, 4 years before Lupo died, Detective Elcock told Tate & Wire,
"It really worries me that we never got an answer as to why he killed his victims. He never explained that. We were just left with an apparently random series of killings with no discernible motive."
Something happened, and I can't for the life of me work out what.
I mean, it was either always that way inclined, or something flipped a switch in his brain as to, you know, what turns somebody into a killer. I mean, is somebody always a killer? You know, have they got these traits? Do they repress them all these years, and then just at the click of a flick of a switch, you turn into a killer, or whatever happens? But like the saddest part about it is, you know, he never said what. Well, I mean, not as though there's got to be a reason for killing someone, but he never said why he took all those innocent lives, which is incredibly sad. You know, there was no,
and I think even the families have been through absolute hell with the losses that they've experienced. And I think really, in a sense of, even if he'd have given an explanation, it would have perhaps caused considerable hurt and pain to the families. But I think, going back to what you said earlier, it would have perhaps given them some sense of closure. It still would have made no sense.
That's it, Will, yeah. It's the families that suffer ultimately, because their child was murdered in cold blood. And they haven't got no answers, and they never will have any answers.
All of the actual newspaper archives mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes.
And if you've enjoyed listening to AIDS The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share, as in the link, not as in, do you believe in life after love? Oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.